Good afternoon and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. New global developments are changing the structures and the holders of power. With new technology and greater interconnectedness, states are losing power and non-state actors are gaining power. But what exactly does it mean to have power, and where exactly does power come from? That's the subject explored by our next esteemed panel. We are joined by three experts on political power. Joseph Nye is the University Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He has published numerous books, including Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics, The Powers to Lead, and his latest, The Future of Power. Giulio Gallerati is professor of government in the College of Social Studies at Wesleyan University. He is the author of The Power Curse, Influence and Illusion in World Politics and Cosmopolitan Power in International Relations, a Synthesis of Realism, Neorealism, and Constructivism. Erica Chenoweth is professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of the Wesleyan Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She is co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, and co-editor of Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict. I think what I'd like to do is start with the concept itself of political power. Of course, this has been long debated in political scientist circles. And an old definition emerging from a scholar, Laswell, said it was who gets what, when, and how. Of course, there have been plenty of others along the way. Professor Dahl and his contemporary said power is the ability to influence or cause change socially, politically, or economically. So why don't we start with what we mean by political power and where it comes from, who has it and who doesn't, and why. Joseph Nye, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I use a definition of power that's pretty close to what the dictionary says. It's the ability to get what you want by affecting others. And you can do this in three basic ways. You can do it with threats of coercion, so-called sticks. You can do it with payments, so-called carrots. Or you can do it by getting others to want what you want. And that's what I call soft power. And if you're able to attract others and get them to do what you want without having to coerce them or pay them, you can save a lot of carrots and sticks. So for me, power is that ability to get the outcomes you want, and those are the three ways you can do it.
Can you give us some examples of what you are talking about with the soft power in terms of politics?
Let me give you an example from Dwight Eisenhower, who was not only a president, but also a general before that. He said at one point, giving somebody a command is not very hard. Getting somebody to do something for you because they want to, he says, that's really hard. And so soft power is that ability to attract others, to get them to do something you want because they want to, not because you're coercing them or paying them.
And where do we see this in terms of the international playing field?
Well, we see it internationally when you come to situations where you can bomb another country or pay another country, or you can get another country to follow you because they're attracted. It's easier to see in the reverse situations. In 2003, President Bush wanted to send American troops into Iraq by having crossed Turkey, and he offered the Turkish government a very large aid package, essentially a bribe. The Turks turned it down because America had become so unpopular, it had lost so much of its soft power of attraction, that the Turkish parliament refused to go along with it. So the 4th Infantry Division, which was supposed to cross Turkey and enter Iraq from the north, had to go down through the canal and up through the Gulf and was late to the war. That's a case where the lack of soft power inhibited American hard power.
I think that's going to lead us later into the discussion about just causes and ethics and where those fall into the realm of soft power. But before we go into that, Giulio Gallerati, let's bring you in. Can you also talk about who has power and why?
Well, to pick up on what Joe said, and obviously he invented these concepts, and they're very important. And a lot of people are talking about them, not just among scholars, but also in the press and, of course, in politics. I wanted to kind of say that the way I conceptualize the difference between hard powers, hard power is a way of coercing people to do what you want. Soft power is a way of cultivating compliance. That's the main difference. That's how I see it. I'd also like to add that the world has changed such that the utility of soft power has increased significantly, and the utility of hard power has decreased significantly, all because of some major changes in the international system over the past 100 years. First of all, because we have a security community among developed nations, and this idea of security community was introduced by Robert Jervis, who suggests that war between major powers is almost unthinkable. Now, in a situation where war and violence between major powers is unthinkable, heavy-handed methods that derive from hard power don't have much utility. People will find it much more difficult to use hard power to get what they want in that situation. Two other changes. One, the growth of economic interdependence. And where you have interdependent agents, it's very difficult, again, to use hard power, heavy-handed methods to get things, because you're both dependent on one another. You're mutually vulnerable. In a case like this, again, soft power is the way to go. And globalization has, of course, reinforced interdependence. Another change has been the rise of democracies, where you have national leaders and populations that fundamentally believe in the rule of law. And in an environment where people do believe in the rule of law, soft power gains much greater utility and much greater respect. Of course, we've also had a proliferation in the number of international organizations in the world and regimes, such that while the system is still anarchic, we've taken greater steps in moving toward a system which is governed much more by the rule of law. And in systems governed by the rule of law, hard power, which really has utility most in pure anarchy, really loses a lot of its utility. So I wanted to add that onto what Professor Nye has already said.
You bring a lot of really important points up in terms of the rule of law, and I think that is going to beg the question about some of the activities related to the United States itself and the issues of torture and the issues of United Nations resolutions and the contradictions there that I'd like to get into. But before we do that, Erica Chenoweth, let's bring you in. You've actually looked at this relationship between state and non-state actors and related in part to democracy, and you've shown by your research the power of this soft power. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what you found.
Well, the way I'm thinking about power these days is a pretty simple definition, which is the ability to get people to obey. And the less it costs for a state to get people to obey, the more powerful they are. In other words, if a state doesn't have to invest that much in domestic security because people are more or less well-behaved and see the government as more or less legitimate, then that's a pretty powerful state. Whereas, counterintuitively, the states that have to spend a ton of money on internal security, like Egypt, for example, under Mubarak, they end up not being as powerful as they look on paper because they don't have the legitimacy that is required to be able to control the population, which is why Mubarak subsequently was ousted. And so my research basically looks at people as the source of power, that is, the population within the state, rather than sort of a top-down definition, because a state is only as powerful, or a leader is only as powerful, as their ability to convince not only the population to behave, but also the people that work for them. So the security forces, the economic elites, the civilian bureaucrats, as soon as those people stop obeying the authority of the leader, you can see that power crumbling. So I think that power really requires obedience in some sense. And what we're seeing around the world these days is sort of a corrosion of the sources of legitimacy that a lot of dictators have taken for granted.
I think you bring up a couple of really important points. One is legitimacy. And I think all three of you have talked about legitimacy a bit. Joseph Nye, let's bring you back in on this. You've talked about perceived legitimacy and this being, I think you called it, the third face of power. How does one become considered legitimate, perceived as legitimate? And how does that translate into power?
Well, legitimacy is a power reality. I mean, human beings don't act simply because they're coerced or because they're paid. We also act because of moral concerns, because we think something is right. And legitimacy is when others think that you have rightful authority. so the question of where that comes from is hotly debated. I mean, based back in the days of monarchies, it was the divine right of kings. What Max Weber pointed out was that it transfers also to the modern rational bureaucratic state. If a state is elected and has a well-ordered government, that's often seen as legitimate. But also legitimacy can be generated by charismatic leaders, somebody who has a particular attractive personality, which seems to give them a sense of right. So there are a variety of sources of legitimacy. I've just mentioned the famous Weberian trio. But in today's modern world, you can see that certain ideas of democracy and human rights and freedoms and so forth are often sources of legitimacy, but they don't necessarily transfer across all cultures. What seems legitimate in the eyes of Americans may not look legitimate in the eyes of Saudi Arabians. So there are various sources of legitimacy, but the common denominator is that people are moved not just by carrots and sticks, but also by a feeling of what's right.
So that's the issue of ethics, morality, or a just cause.
Yeah, morality is a power reality. It's as simple as that.
So how does that fit in now with the idea of, say, and this actually fits with something else you've talked about, Joseph Nye, in your latest book, which is the issue of imperialism. You use the phrase imperial overstretch, in that having compromised the United States' power potentially because of this moral issue. And last time you and I spoke, I asked you, isn't all imperialism imperial overstretch?
Well, imperial overstretch is the term was used by Paul Kennedy, the famous Yale historian, referred to the fact that as countries try to control areas beyond their borders, it becomes more and more expensive for them. And this indeed is what happened to the Soviet Union. The cost of military budget rose and rose so that eventually it became something like 22% of their gross domestic product. And so the more you try to control what's overseas, the more your expenses in the military sense go up as a percent of the total, and that's imperial overstretch. The United States doesn't fit that model in the following sense, that military budget's about 5% of our gross domestic product today, and that's has half of what it was during the Cold War. So rather than increasingly being overstretched budgetary terms over a long historical period like the Soviet Union was, we have not been. In the short run, right now of our current budgetary crisis, there is some tension between overseas operations like Afghanistan and the American military budget. But I don't really see the American situation as one of imperial overstretch in the sense that Kennedy defined the term.
Giulio Gallerati, would you agree?
I'm going to have to disagree with Joe on this, probably the first time I ever have. I do think that we're in a situation now where we have unrivaled hegemony. We have a global presence that's never been seen in history. Over 700 bases in 130 countries, with roughly 4.5 million people, both civilian and military, carrying on operations. We're spending $400 million a day in Afghanistan and Iraq alone. Our power in nuclear weapons is unrivaled. And, of course, you know, we spend, you know, the famous fact that we spend, the military budget is a little less than the rest of the world combined. I do think that we are in a situation where we can no longer rule the world and deliver the American dream. And I think of this quote by Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching, who said, "He who commands others is powerful, but he who masters himself is mightier still." I think in this particular case, we have an interesting paradox of external power, external hegemony, and internal weakness. I do believe we have some severe domestic problems. And even though Joe's quite right that if you look at it in terms of GNP and a comparative study, our defense spending is not exaggerated. However, when you consider the sensitive situation our domestic economy and society is in, we do see that there's a trade-off. And we are, at this point, a society in disrepair, I think, with 50 million people uninsured and with middle-class people being unable to afford the full price of health care insurance. And they're unable to afford tuitions at elite colleges. our government deficit at this point is literally threatening the very institutions that undergird our social safety net, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This country, as rich as it is 21st in literacy. Our public education is deteriorating, and we have millions of people in prison and millions of people homeless. So I do think that even though as a percentage of GNP it's small, you know, some kind of redistribution of that money to these domestic problems would make great contributions to alleviating these problems. So I'm going to disagree a little bit with Joe on this.
I want to also ask you, Giulio Gallerati, is there a relationship between all of this spending and presence in other countries and their own struggles for democracy and the soft power of the United States as you see it?
Well, we don't really have an empire in a classical definition in terms of having colonies. I think Chalmers Johnson is the one that pushed this phrase, an American empire. I think what we're really talking about is just the present. And clearly we have many, many bases, as I've said, and in some of these situations there's really no conflict of interest. People are happy to have us there. The military are providing a number of public goods to the various communities. In fact, paradoxically, the military bases provide a lot of infrastructure and public goods, so in a sense, they're providing a lot of soft power themselves. But other occupations, for example, Afghanistan and Iraq, they're quite different in nature. And so I think what you're seeing is, in terms of our military presence and what it means, there's definitely a mixed bag. It's not all evil, but it definitely generates points of controversy that cut against our legitimacy and influence in the world.
Eric Kitchen, with anything you'd like to add?
What occurred to me when I was listening to my colleagues is just that there is a group of scholars who argue that you can't really think of power, or at least American hegemony, in absolute terms. So a better question to ask sometimes is not just is American hegemony declining, but is it declining relative to other competitors or rival powers who are increasing in their power? And fortunately or unfortunately for the United States, many of its rivals at the moment are also suffering recession, or they have, as in China, significant development challenges that make it a long way off from being a real competitor. But nevertheless, there is a finite amount of power that any one country can accumulate, even if it is the most powerful country in the world at a given time. Basically, the history of international relations has been substitutions of empires, you know, one after the other. It was Britain and then the U.S. and the USSR and the U.S. and then who knows who's next. It rotates. Given where other great powers are today, that we don't really have to worry about any type of steep decline in the immediate future.
Joseph Nye, let's bring you back in. You've talked about how power is changing now in the 21st century, in part due to the economics, in part due to natural resources. You see a new rise of some states and a decline of others. How do you see this shaping up?
Well, I argue in The Future of Power that there are two big power shifts going on in this century. One is a shift from west to east, which you might call the recovery of Asia. So that Asia will recover during this century to being more than half the world's population and half the world's product, which is where it was before the Industrial Revolution in the West. That's a good process. That means more people are escaping poverty. It does, though, mean that there's a fear in some cases, for example, that China will become a considerable competitor and take over from the United States. I agree with Eric, as I said, that that's not imminent, and Asia has its own internal balance of power. The Japanese and Indians and Vietnamese don't want the Chinese to take over, and in that sense, they want an American presence. So I think there is a big power shift from west to east, but Asia is not one thing. I think the Americans are not about to be overtaken by China. I do think, however, that the second power shift that I talk about, which is the shift of power away from all governments to non-governmental actors, is something that is more of concern. And that really is the effect of the enormous change that the information revolution has brought about of reducing the barriers to entry of playing a direct role in international politics. It's not that the governments are obsolete, but it just means the stage on which governments act is a lot more crowded because players who were previously priced out of the action can now play in the game. And that we see most dramatically in the area of cyber power. You can be attacked now and don't know whether it's an attack by a hacker or by a criminal group or by another state. And so individuals or private actors are able to do things which previously were restricted primarily to governments. So these are the two big power shifts I see going on among states from west to east and among all states from states to non-state actors.
When you talked about non-state actors in your book, when you wrote about them, one of the other emerging non-state actors that you talked about having an enormous amount of power now are these international corporations because of the massive amounts of money that they move around. You said they're bigger than many states. Can you talk about what the effect of that is?
Yeah, the transnational corporation has been around for a long time, but its power has been increased by the information revolution, so that now you can find companies which will operate in dozens of countries with hundreds of thousand employees and able to shift the sources of the goods or sales quite quickly because of the Internet. And they can also shift vast amounts of money. I mean, you can get transactions, in some cases, can be bigger than the budgets of some countries. So there is enormous power in corporations. But it's one thing worth noticing about corporations is that well-organized governments have three sources of power: their military capacity, their economic capacity, and their legitimacy. Corporations rarely have military capacity, and they may have legitimacy, but it's questionable in some cases. So they really are resting a lot of their power heavily on one leg of the stool, which is the economic leg.
Which is a pretty powerful leg.
Very much so. Very much so.
Well, Erica Chenoweth, since we're talking about non-state actors and since you study people and revolutionary movements, can you talk about the rise of these movements and their effect on the future of power?
Sure. My research and my newest book with Maria Steffen basically points to this argument that nonviolent mass resistance has increased both in its frequency and its effectiveness in the past 50 or so years. Although it certainly existed and succeeded before that. What we argue is that when a movement is able to achieve a certain level of participation from within the society and across a number of different sectors of gender, religion, ideology, party, class, etc., they're often able to basically throw out leaders that they view as corrupt or incompetent. Even in very repressive or harsh dictatorships, they've often been able to expel foreign occupations, and they've often been able to cause secession or independence. And one of the most interesting findings is that these movements tend to be even more successful than violent insurgencies. And the reason this is interesting is because I think that it's been more or less conventional wisdom up until now that if you really want to get something done and you're a non-state actor and you don't have the monopoly on the use of force and you don't have the legitimacy of the state, you have to use violence to make that happen. And what we found actually is that these nonviolent resistance movements are more than twice as successful as their violent competitors. So ultimately what this says to me is that when large groups of people withdraw their obedience from the state and refuse to cooperate, they can affect major change in countries that have been stagnant for decades. And we're actually seeing this, I think, in what a lot of people are referring to as the Arab Spring. I think that it has such potential for changing the landscape of so many countries around the world that we're going to see its use more frequently and we're going to see its success more frequently as well.
How would you contrast what is happening now in Greece with what we saw with the Arab Spring?
Well, I think the Arab Spring has really created a demonstration effect, is what we would call it, which is basically that it's inspiring other movements around the world to also basically withdraw their obedience from the state. Not everybody is going to withdraw their obedience from the state in the same way or toward the same goals. And what I see in Greece is basically a group of people that actually have a long history of rising up against their government. And it's interesting because a lot of the reports coming out from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have indicated that there's some brutal repression going on. So it actually shares a lot in common with a lot of what's been going on in the Arab Spring.
Giulio Gallerotti, you actually get the last word. So if you'd like to make concluding thoughts in this, feel free.
A couple of points I wanted to make is that the power game, the idea of power, national power, is very nebulous. It's a very uncertain game. Most people disagree about what it is, both scholars and national leaders. One thing that is troubling about power is that no one really knows how powerful they are, because power can only be identified and assessed when it's activated. We don't know how powerful we are before we're actually using it in a situation, whether it's a confrontation or a crisis. And it's hard to simulate a crisis or a confrontation. We can try, but we can only guess. So until that comes, we don't really know how powerful we are. Vietnam proved that we weren't very powerful, even though we thought we were. Another interesting characteristic about power and how leaders build power is that power is retrospective. Game or the process of power accumulation is retrospective. There's an old saying that we're always preparing to win the last war. And that's because people overlearn from history. Certain crises or events really dictate how we respond in terms of accumulating power in the future. A lot of experts on terrorism suggest that our approach to terrorism now is very backward-looking and not proactive. We're always trying to prevent that which happened before, but that terrorists are forward-looking, and they're always trying to find new ways of doing it. They're certainly not going to do it the way they did it before. So these are two troubling characteristics of power that suggest that it's hard for us to wrap our heads around it, and it's very, very hard for us to ensure that we're building up the kind of power that we desire.
We are out of time. There's so many more things that we could cover, perhaps in a future taping, including the three of you have all talked about democracy and that being one of the potential soft power, smart powers is advancing human rights and democracy and the United States' role in that, especially when the elections don't turn out how we like them. But for now, thank you so much for being with us. We've been speaking with Joseph Nye, who is a distinguished service professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And his books include Soft Power, The Means to Success in the World Politics, The Powers to Lead, and The Future of Power. Giulio Gallerati is professor of government in the College of Social Studies at Wesleyan University. He's the author of The Power Curse, Influence and Illusion in World Politics, Cosmopolitan Power and International Relations, A Synthesis of Realism, Neoliberalism, and Constructivism. And Erica Chenoweth, professor of government at Wesleyan University, director of Wesleyan's Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research, visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at University of California, Berkeley, and author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also, special thanks to Ismail Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armoodian.com. See you next week.